It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert is off today. Coming up on Central Time, in Curious Wisconsin, we'll learn about Pepe, the lake monster of the Mississippi River. First, according to a report made public yesterday, less than a third of people who lost Medicaid coverage this year under Governor Walker's changes to BadgerCare signed up for health insurance on the federal exchange. That means more than 38,000 of the 63,000 people who lost BadgerCare are now without state or exchange coverage. While some may have acquired health insurance by other means, the news suggests a significant gap currently in coverage. That's got our next guest concerned. Senator Tammy Baldwin is with us now to react to the news and what she thinks needs to happen next. Senator Baldwin, welcome to the show.
It's a delight to join you. Thank you.
Well, Governor Walker's plan was that the 63,000 Wisconsinites who were being pushed out of BadgerCare, they were going to get plans under the Affordable Care Act marketplace. According to these numbers this week, not everyone made that jump. What do you think happened?
Well, I'm really disappointed to see that nearly 60% of these pretty vulnerable Wisconsinites that the governor kicked off BadgerCare remain unaccounted for despite the governor's promise. We are told that about 38,000 did not successfully transition to the Affordable Care Act marketplace. And we really want to know where they are now. I look back to the dialogue that I've had with the governor's office on this issue for now well over a year and a half about, first of all, urging him to expand Medicaid so that all of those folks could have stayed on BadgerCare and saved the state a lot of money. But when he decided to take a different course to not expand Medicaid, I called on him to do everything within his power to make that a smooth and seamless transition for these individuals and family members, and it just appears as though it hasn't worked.
And what do you think went wrong? What are the barriers that are keeping people off these plans? Cost? Or is it maybe the fault of that rocky rollout of healthcare.gov?
You know, I really believe that, first of all, BadgerCare and the Medicaid program serves an important purpose for people who are very low income. The reality is that many of these individuals are making as little as $12,000 a year, less than the minimum wage. Oftentimes, this would have been their first exposure to insurance because Medicaid works a little bit differently than the private insurance options on the marketplace. And really, a lot of assistance was needed. And I just don't feel like the letter that I remember seeing the first letter that the state sent out to people talking about the fact that they were losing their benefits. It says, someone in this household is on BadgerCare, and this is, you know, basically communicating that they were about to lose it. But I feel like it was a real failure on the governor's part. And again, this was his decision, and the legislature went along with it, not to accept 100% federal funding for the first few years to expand Medicaid and keep these individuals in BadgerCare.
One of the arguments for that decision from the governor and others was that, yes, the federal government says the money is going to be there. Can we really count on it? Will parties change in the White House? Will something happen in Congress that takes that funding away, leaves us in the lurch? Look right now, you guys can't pass a bill to rebuild the highways right now, so we can't count on that.
Well, I certainly think that One thing that's for sure is that the choice to expand Medicaid could be reexamined at any moment in either direction. He could expand and then ask the legislature to not at another point in time. So this is voluntary. But we are losing $119 million in that are on the shoulders of Wisconsin taxpayers because of Walker's choice, according to the State Legislative Fiscal Bureau. And 38,000 individuals who used to have BadgerCare coverage have been, well, we actually know that their fate is uncertain. We just know that they haven't aren't enrolled in private health insurance through the marketplace. And I think that was an irresponsible decision on the part of a governor who's been promising there would be no gaps, promising that this would be a seamless transition.
State Health Secretary Kitty Rhodes said in a statement, came out along with these numbers, that, hey, these aren't a complete picture. Some of the people that 38,000 we're talking about might have gotten coverage through a job, a spouse. They might have gone to the private market, but not through the exchange. They're not showing up. So do you think that's a significant number of people?
You know, we don't know, because they haven't done their job in terms of outreach and follow-up. But I fear that a significant percentage of those 38,000 probably have no coverage.
Is it too late for Wisconsin to take the federal money now, or could the state reverse that decision in the future with Governor Walker or with a change of administration?
It is not too late. And in fact, the new Secretary of Health and Human Services, Sylvia Matthews-Burwell, is getting out there and meeting with those Republican governors who have refused to expand Medicaid, and saying there's still a chance to follow the path that other governors have throughout this country, governors of both parties, I might mention. But she is more than willing to work with states at any point. And boy, I continue to urge the governor to do this. Again, the cost to Wisconsin taxpayers is estimated by the Legislative Fiscal Bureau to be about $119 million. We have overall, according to their figures, 85,000 fewer individuals covered than had the governor accepted the federal investment in Badger Care through the Affordable Care Act. And that's a mistake for Wisconsin, and we should reexamine it.
Assuming that change isn't made, the plan, the governor's plan, they stick with that. The open enrollment period to get insurance through the exchange has ended for this year. A new period starts, I think, mid-November to get coverage on the beginning of the first of the year. What would you want to see happen between now and then to get more of those 38,000 people on the healthcare exchange?
Well, certainly I think that the governor ought to be directing his administration to do further outreach. They have the information as to who these individuals and families are. They actually are required to do that outreach by virtue of the waiver they have from the Department of Health and Human Services to run our Badger Care program. And I think they need to work more aggressively. 38,000 Wisconsinites falling through the cracks is not acceptable.
Even if they do sign up between now and then, it'll be 6 months before they're on coverage. What is the impact of that, that many people uncovered?
Well, you know, these are, healthcare is very personal, and it's individual stories. Hopefully, people don't have a health situation, an injury, an illness, but we know that people who lack insurance and do have illness often defer going to the doctor because, again, we're talking about very vulnerable, very low-income individuals and family members, and oftentimes wait until an illness grows more severe. We also know that people without insurance present at more expensive settings like emergency rooms. And so it's the reason why we want something like the Affordable Care Act, is so that more people have coverage and seek preventative care and seek care early before an illness gets out of control.
Briefly, this is an election year. Neither of Wisconsin's U.S. senators are up for re-election, but many are. There are thoughts that Republicans might take over the Senate. If that happens, Republicans control both houses of Congress. Are you worried about the Affordable Care Act and funding for it?
I'm certainly not worried about the repeal of the Affordable Care Act, despite the fact that the House has attempted on 50 occasions to repeal or defund it. We know that any legislation seeking to accomplish that would be vetoed by the president, and that veto certainly would not be overridden, even if there were a change of control in the U.S. Senate. But I would also predict, as somebody serving Wisconsin in the U.S. Senate right now, I don't think there's going to. My prediction is that there will not be a partisan change in control.
Senator Baldwin, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob, for covering this really critical issue.
That was U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin. It's summertime in Wisconsin, high time to swim in our lakes and rivers. But beware when swimming in the Mississippi River, especially in Lake Pepin. According to legend, a monster named Pepe lives there. Chad Lewis is here to discuss the phenomenon. He's a paranormal researcher. He's co-author of Pepe, the Lake Monster of the Mississippi River. Chad, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me back.
So, according to legend, what is Pepe?
Well, Pepe, by all accounts, is a sea serpent. What you would think of when you traditionally think of the Loch Ness Monster or the Lake Champlain Monster, this thing that science says doesn't exist. Skeptics say it can exist, yet every year people seem to see it.
And set the scene for us. You've spent some time out on Lake Pepin. Describe the environment you're studying here.
Yeah, Lake Pepin runs along the Mississippi River. It's actually a lake on the river. It's a bit of an oddity. It's 22 miles long. It separates Wisconsin and Minnesota, nearly 2 miles wide at its widest. So it's a big lake surrounded by beautiful bluffs, and you can just imagine the beauty of it, that something might be inhabiting it underneath.
And when were the first legends, the first sightings and stories of Pepe?
We have stories going back to Father Louis Hennepin in the 1600s, making expeditions for France to the area, talking about a large serpent-like snake, 8 to 9 feet in length, as big as a man's leg. And then it goes on there to the Native Americans who first settled the area, and they were talking about only taking the strongest canoes out in the water in hopes that it could fend off an attack by this beast. And then once the white pioneers started settling the area, they started writing about it in their newspapers. And we have accounts dating back to 1867 of something the size between a rhinoceros and an elephant inhabiting the waters of Lake Pepin.
Now, you write in the book, there were sturgeon in the lake, some really big ones. Is it possible that, you know, sturgeon big enough to jar somebody's canoe were there and maybe the tail grew in the telling?
Yes, certainly. There are huge sturgeon. It is known for large catfish. There are alligator gar in the Mississippi. I have a report from the early 1900s of people believing they were being eaten by these alligator gars, which they said were 9 to 10 feet in length, 300 pounds, and covered in a scale-like armor. So if something like that brushed against you, by all accounts, you would think it was a sea serpent.
So what, since the earlier legends you mentioned, I know you recount a bunch in the late 1800s. What kind of things were people writing about, telling each other about then?
Well, back then, they really didn't have much of an idea of how big and deep the lake was. They thought it was so big that whales might be in it. And of course, it's not very deep. Average depth of 25 feet. It does get up to about 75, 80 feet in depth. So it's not gigantic in that terms, but they really didn't know. It was an era when Wisconsin and the rest of the country was overrun with sea serpent reports from all over the lakes, rivers, and streams. But as time went on, they got more and more good descriptions by what they claimed were credible people at that time.
And so tell us how did it take shape? What does Pepe look like in the tales people were sharing then?
Over the last couple hundred years, it seems to take two different viewings of it. One is what we would consider a large snake-like or a giant eel. People talking about a 30-foot-long snake, you know, 16 inches in diameter, something around that area where you would think of a giant anaconda, if you will. The other sightings are more of the traditional humpback, long-necked serpent, like you would think of the old plesiosaurs of past. so more of a Loch Ness type monster. So we get reports of two of these, whether it's the same creature or multiple creatures, we just don't know.
And what were the theories people were offering here for how this creature would come to live there?
Well, many people believe that it may have swam up from the ocean, that it made its way up, and then once the lock and dam system started being constructed along the Mississippi, that it was simply trapped in Lake Pepin, because the majority of sightings do happen in Lake Pepin, even though they do occur throughout the Mississippi River all the way down to the Gulf, of course. But many people believe that it was just simply trapped there, or that it's always been there and it's just an undiscovered species.
And I gather there was a $50,000 reward at one point. I don't know if that's still going for conclusive, definitive proof.
Yes, thanks to a Lake City, Minnesota businessman, Larry Nielsen. He thought that they were not promoting the history of the legend well enough, and he had just sat down and watched a documentary about Loch Ness, and he noticed the similarities. The only difference was everybody's heard of the Loch Ness Monster, while nobody had really heard of Pepe. So he decided that he was going to put a reward for this creature's capture, and he posted a $50,000 reward that all of your listeners should know is still open to this day.
Now, you've been out on, and in some cases, in the lake. What kind of things did you do to try to find Pepe?
I've been on dozens of day expeditions, and my co-author Noah Voss and I went on a couple multi-day expeditions on our vessels, and we were using everything from sonar, underwater cameras, fishing equipment. We even dove in and used ourselves as bait, if you will. And unfortunately, during our expeditions, of course, we did not capture Pepe, but what I found most fascinating is that everyone we pulled up to and asked them, people fishing, we'd ask if they had seen Pepe, and of course the majority had not, but I was taken back by so many people said that they had brought a camera or video camera with them just in case.
Just in case.
And these were the type of people you wouldn't think would be out there looking for Pepe, but they had a camera just on the off chance.
What's your next planned expedition there?
I'm looking to go back next summer. Last summer, 2013, was the last one I was at, and your listeners should know I'm doing this interview live on location from the banks of Lake
Oh, you're
Lake
overlooking
Pepin.
Lake Pepin, okay.
Yeah, I'm overlooking it right now. I'm on the Wisconsin side near Maiden Rock, which has a legend attached to it as well, but I'm scanning the waters. But next summer, I think I'm going to launch another multi-day expedition to try to find out what is causing so many of these sightings.
Well, some people might point toward a hoax to drum up tourism. Others, suggestion you write about, maybe this is susceptibility. People go in thinking they're going to see it, see what they want to see.
Yeah, and it could be a combination of those things. Obviously, some people may have seen a large sturgeon and were spooked by it. Whereas others, the details, even most recent ones, are so good in detail, and they got such a good glimpse of it, some of them against their will in the water, and they quickly got out of the water, but that it leaves me to think something is in Lake Pepin, but what that is, I don't know, and maybe one of your listeners will be the lucky one to find out.
When you're out in the water or on the water, I think in one case accidentally in the water, do you feel safe there?
I have to say, I've swam in some of the most monster-infested waters, including a couple times at Loch Ness in Scotland. And even though it's never attacked anybody, it's never harmed anybody that we know of, there's still something about swimming in there. You keep a little bit closer eyes on your limbs when you're in that water, that's for sure.
And what do the locals think when you tell them you're looking for Pepe? They're curious, think you're nuts. Where do they fall on that?
A lot of the locals, it's a combination. Some of them, of course, will just scoff at it and say that's nothing more than a tourist ploy to get people to Lake City. And others will then surprisingly tell you their story or a story they heard from their grandmother or grandfather. So many people do take it seriously just because of the long history of it, and they're curious as to what it is as well.
All right. Well, Chad, enjoy your time out by Lake Pepin there, and thanks for joining us.
Hey, keep an eye out.
All right. That was Chad Lewis. He's a paranormal researcher. He's the author of Pepe, the Lake Monster of the Mississippi River. The Israeli military has begun a ground invasion of the Gaza Strip. At 10:39 p.m. local time, they released a statement saying the purpose of the offensive is to, quote, establish a reality in which Israeli residents can live in safety and security without continuous indiscriminate terror. Here with a reaction to the invasion is Professor of Middle Eastern Studies at UW-Madison, Jennifer Lowenstein. She's an expert in the Arab-Israeli conflict. Jennifer, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me on.
So what is your reaction to the news of this announcement?
Well, it's devastating to the people of the Gaza Strip. It's devastating for many reasons, but I think people must understand that the Gaza Strip has 1.7 million people in it. It's one of the most densely populated areas of land on Earth. But most devastatingly for them is that there's no place for anyone to go. You cannot get out of the Gaza Strip. It is closed by land, sea, and air completely. So when the bombs fall and the tanks come rolling in, people can't do anything. There's no place to run and hide. There are no shelters. There are no bomb shelters. So there are going to be inevitably a very large number of casualties because you can't strike a home without killing people who are completely innocent.
There's been speculation over the last week and a half that Israel might do this, might launch a ground invasion. Why do you think they've chosen to do it now?
I think the pretext is to restore calm. According to Gideon Levy, a well-known Israeli journalist in the magazine Haaretz, according to him, the primary goal of this operation called Operation Protective Edge is to kill people, to kill Arabs. And I think he is right on the mark. There is an ethnic cleansing program underway in Israel, in the occupied territories that Israel has controlled since 1967. They have no intention of letting go of that land. The settlements that are being illegally built in the West Bank and in East Jerusalem are not going to be dismantled. Israel has made that decision and made it 40 years ago. The purpose of this is to make the conditions within Gaza and also in the West Bank so terrible that people will want to get out, that you will decimate the population of Palestinians living in Gaza, terrify the people living in the West Bank, hope that the most number of people possible will leave, and presumably wipe out Hamas. I say presumably because that's not in Israel's interest, despite the fact that Hamas is not a very, it's a terrible government. It's a terrible organization.
Well, and we've heard, including from Senator Ron Johnson, the show here yesterday, Hamas had the ability to end this conflict, the bombing, by stopping the rocket launches, by stopping the immediate threat to Israel. Wouldn't that have prevented this ground invasion from Israel?
What would have prevented the ground invasion by Israel would have been for both parties to sit down at the negotiating table and to hammer this out in a legal way. Aggression against an undefended population, and I say undefended because the overwhelming, by far overwhelming majority of the people of Gaza have no means of protection. There is no standing army. There is no military other than these primitive rockets, which I do not condone. But as to answer your question, Hamas is firing rockets. That's not the proper way to respond. I don't condone it. But what Israel is doing is considered the supreme war crime, the war crime of aggression against a population that is under an illegal occupation.
But doesn't Israel have a responsibility to its own citizens to try to stop these rocket attacks?
Absolutely. And it could do so overnight by getting out of the West Bank and getting out of the Gaza Strip and getting out of East Jerusalem, territories that Israel occupied in 1967 illegally and that should have been returned within the year and in which the building of settlements and checkpoints throughout these territories is completely illegal, there's no reason whatsoever for the rockets from Gaza to be fired. It's a response by a desperate population to try to say to their own people, we're not just lying down and taking this. I don't approve of it. I would much prefer to see nonviolent resistance, which is by far the majority of the kind of resistance that the Palestinian people have shown. But the answer is to go to the negotiating table. Israel will not deal with Hamas. It is already trying to break the unity agreement between Fatah and Hamas, which is very unstable as it is. They're not going to accomplish this by going into Gaza and turning it into a moonscape. What will happen is an even more radical party could potentially emerge because people are so desperate.
Professor Lowenstein, we'll leave it there for now. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me on.
That's Jennifer Lowenstein, professor at Middle East Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. We'll continue our coverage of Israel's ground invasion of Gaza with the editor-in-chief of the Israel Studies Forum. That'll be at 5:30, and tune into NPR News in the meantime. Are African Americans less interested in the environment, not as comfortable in nature as their white peers, or maybe even in some ways excluded from those spaces? Professor Carolyn Finney of the University of California, Berkeley, looks at those questions and possible reasons why in her new book, Black Faces, White Spaces, Reimagining the Relationship of African Americans to the Great Outdoors. Professor Finney, welcome to Central Time.
Yeah, hi, Rob. Thanks so much for having me on the show.
Well, you start off with a personal story of your own interest in the land. Can you start us off with that?
I can, because this project, you know, was really a personal one, or it started from a personal place. I grew up about a half an hour outside of New York City in Westchester County. My parents came from Virginia, had a high school education. When my dad got done with the Korean War, like a lot of African Americans in the 50s who were living in the South, they came north hoping that they would have better job opportunities. And when he got to New York, he basically had two job options. He could be a janitor in Syracuse, New York, which is about 5 hours upstate, or he could be a caretaker for a wonderful estate about 30 minutes outside of the city owned by a very wealthy Jewish family. And that's the job he took. So my parents were the caretakers, gardeners, chauffeur, housekeeper for that estate for 50 years. They lived in the gardener's cottage on that estate. They wanted to have kids. I tell people they thought they couldn't have kids, so they adopted me. And then, like I like to say, they relaxed, and so I have two brothers. my brothers and I grew up on this estate. It's a 12-acre estate. It has a swimming pool, a pond, gardens, lots of different kinds of wildlife on this estate. And we basically had the run of that estate during the week because the owners generally only came up on the weekends and holidays. It's a very wealthy white neighborhood. We were the only family of color in that neighborhood. And so one of the stories I often tell in presentations is that I say that when I was nine, I remember walking home from school one day and, you know, fourth grade, had my school bag, and there were always policemen patrolling the neighborhood. And I got stopped by this white policeman who wanted to know where I was going. And I told him because I was just around the corner from the house. And then he looked at me and he said, oh, do you work there? Hmm. And I remember thinking, I'm nine. You know, no, and all I could say to him was, no, I live there. But I think that was one of those moments that I really understood that the color of my skin really challenged any logical idea he might have, looking at a little nine-year-old girl with her school bag and imagining she couldn't possibly live here in this neighborhood, so she must work here, even though I was only 9 years old. So I just want to flash forward a little bit. When I really started thinking about this as a project, I had gone back to school later on in life, and in the early 2000s, I was working on my doctorate, and I thought my parents were still on this property, but at this point, the original owners had died, And to their credit, before they died, they understood, the family understood what's going to happen to my parents, who are now much older. And it's much more challenging to care for a big property like that when you get older. And so they eventually had a house built for them back in Virginia. And so my parents were still on the property, though, part-time. And they finally moved. And that they've been living in Leesburg, Virginia now for about, I guess, 10 years or so. My father has been pretty depressed the whole time, ever since he left New York. And I think one of the things that got me motivated to think about land, ownership, environment, whose story counts, is both my parents, my father's depression about leaving that land. What does it mean? What does real ownership mean? They cared for that land for 50 years. But they could never own that land because they could never afford it. The property taxes alone at that time are over $125,000 a year, and my parents would never be able to afford anything like that. There's now a conservation easement on the property because the new owner decided he was going to have that done, and a letter went out to all the neighbors in the area, and somebody sent a copy of the letter to my parents to say, oh, you need to know this is what's happening with the property now. And I read the letter because they showed me a copy, and the Westchester Conservation Organization was saying, really thanking the new owner for his conservation mindedness, was really saying, you know, this is really important in the watershed there, you know, all the birds and flora and fauna that are on this property, you know, and we're really kind of congratulating him on making this choice. But there was nothing in the letter thanking my parents, the people who cared for that land for 50 years, which really started me thinking about a lot of people throughout this country who have cared for, who have worked land for long periods of time, but their story, their experience, you know, we don't hear about that.
And a lot of the things you just mentioned point toward a big theme in your book, whether we're talking about the policeman or that letter to your parents. Mm-hmm. When we think of environment, we associate white faces with people owning the land, enjoying the land, conserving the land. Is that common for white and African Americans?
Well, let me just be really, I want to make sure that I'm not speaking for all black people or white people either, right? So I sort of make this. My opinion is partially based on the research I've done, my own personal experience, talking to a lot of different people, and the reading that I've done in my own perspective. So I really want to put that out
there.
So I'm not saying that this is the way it is. But I think that when I think about the founding of this country, and I say that in quotes too, that, you know, and the national parks as one way within which, you know, how America kind of created an identity for itself to say, you know, we have these incredible outdoor natural spaces like the Grand Canyon and Yellowstone, and this really says something about who we are as a people and a place. But to understand that the founding of those parks partially happened because Native Americans were removed from that land. At the time that founding happened, at the time that European Americans, many were coming over here and were able to claim land under the Homestead Act, black people who were recently freed from being slaves could not participate in that land grab. So when I think about, and this is just really broad strokes, but really just thinking about those founding narratives about who we are, who the environment is, what land looks like, what our relationship to the environment should look like when I think about conservation as a field or preservation, John Muir, all of these ideas. I'm not denigrating the ideas, but these ideas come from a very particular perspective, which is why I think we often think of white faces as controlling the mainstream environmental movement and sort of being central to this kind of environmental narrative. But there's a whole lot of other environmental narratives out there that are taking place, that have always been taking place at the same time.
And that's a big point you make in your book, that you'd like to see in the media, in national park literature, you'd like to see those narratives alongside the ones that are already there. What kind of things would you like to see?
Oh, I would like to see so many things. I was so privileged to talk with and meet so many amazing people and their stories. And so I tell a few of them because I was just blown away by how creative and innovative was. So when I think about somebody like, and actually you all in Wisconsin probably know him, John Francis.
Yes, he's been on this network, definitely.
Exactly, right. I mean, when I met John, I met him one time at a conference and I just followed him around. I was like, John, I must be your friend.
Well, do tell his story though. Remind us of that, please.
His story of, you know, he lived out here in the Bay Area back in the 70s, and there was a small oil spill that happened, and it upset him so much that he decided he wasn't going to take any motorized transport for a while. And he said he did that for like a week or so, but he was always getting in arguments with his friends and everything because he wouldn't get in their trucks or in their cars or take a ride. So he eventually decided he was going to stop talking. And for the next 22 years, John walked across the United States and Latin America to raise awareness about the environment. He did that for 17 years without talking. He got his PhD at University of Wisconsin without talking. I think about his story, and his story, I must say, in the last couple of years is getting more traction in the mainstream. But I think the environmental movement as a whole has been slow to adopt him as a kind of story, not just for Black people, but for everyone to relate to. Or the story of Mavin Bech, the beach lady from American Beach off the coast on Amelia Island off the coast of Jacksonville, Florida. Mavin Bech gave away all her wealth to environmental causes, over $750,000 to that. And she worked really hard to protect. American Beach was a Black beach in the 40s and 50s in Florida because her great-grandfather, he was a millionaire. But in the South, during that time, during the time of Jim Crow, you know, Black people couldn't go to the beaches that white people were going to. And so her great-grandfather bought that strip of beach. So it would be a place that Black people could own homes on the beach. You could be a judge. You could be a janitor. But you could own a home on the beach. Your family could come to the beach. And she really worked hard before her death to preserve not just the beach, because developers, you know, wanted to come in and buy up that property and put in yet another golf course and the maritime forest that was there and the beautiful sand dunes that were there. She really saw a need to protect them, but also to protect the African-American history of that place, and that those two things are intertwined, that the story is as important as the natural environment itself. It's because it's something that goes together. There's a relationship there. I could keep talking. You know, Rob, you have to stop me because I have so many stories that I could tell of incredible people, Black people around the country who are thinking outside of the box, who are doing the work, sometimes doing the work and not recognizing it as green or environmental, you know, but they are doing the work because they see that it needs to be done, like Brenda Palms Barber in Chicago, who's working with previously incarcerated Black men and women, you know, who come out of jail, can't get a job, and now she's got them making urban honey and has a very successful business, Sweet Beginnings. That's a green business.
How does telling and hearing those stories change the way African Americans think about the land and nature and everybody else, too, for that matter?
I think that's right. I think that. So it's something I was just saying last night to some people. I was saying, you know, I think everybody's got a good story. And there's always something there that we all can learn from. So, yes, I believe these stories are something that we all can learn from. But in particular, one of the things I discovered in talking to a lot of different Black people across the country was when I would start interviewing them and talking to them and sometimes saying, so tell me your story. And sometimes they would say to me, oh, you know, I don't have an environmental story. I don't have a story. And I would have to stop them and say, you know, everybody's got a story. And part of that indicated to me the way, you know, nature and environment has been framed and largely talked about actually unintentionally, perhaps, excludes other people from that conversation because they think, oh, you know, I can't talk about it like that. My story of nature and the environment doesn't look like that. My family didn't go to the national parks. I probably didn't go to my first national park till I was sometime in my 30s, you know, which I'm on the National Parks Advisory Board now. But I mean, but I was outside all the time, and as was my family. So part of it for me is also getting people, primarily people who work in environmental institutions and organizations that want to engage difference broadly defined, to really see those stories differently, right? To see those stories as having creative potential in terms of how those environmental organizations do their work and engage diverse communities. Does that make sense?
I think so. One thing I wanted to get to that struck me, and you talked to a lot of people, as you said, couple quotes that point toward almost a fear of nature. Quote, the tree is associated with lynching, end quote, and there's a lot of trees in those woods and rope is cheap. How much did the slavery era and the era of lynching going all the way well into the 1900s, how much has that shaped the way people think of trees and by extension nature?
So I have to preface this too. I really You know, at the end of the book, I start off by talking about fear. And one of the reasons I do that is because a number of people had asked me to talk about that. But surprisingly, actually, it was often white scholars or other people working with me wanted me to talk about that fear. And I think that that fear is real. But I want to really emphasize that the fear is not the thing, right? Mm-hmm. Because, you know, if I think collectively about African Americans and living through slavery, Jim Crow segregation, racial profiling, redlining, all the things that we have experienced collectively and continue to experience in this country, that if we were totally only motivated by our fear, I don't think we would make any kind of movement forward at all. For me, it's really about the resilience, that in spite of or despite of these things happening, how we manage to think more expansively about who we are, what a tree actually means, what it means for us to go into the woods. Having said that, I think we can also be a practical people, like anybody was. You want to protect yourself no matter what the color of your skin is. And so understanding the history of this country, for me, the history isn't simply something in the past. There's a legacy of that in the present. I talk about, for instance, in the Jenna tree, that whole story in the last few years about you know, the white kids saying that there was a tree in the schoolyard, but black kids weren't allowed to sit under it. This stuff, these images, these stories, they're coming up all the time. They're spouting up all the time in our consciousness as Americans because it's part of our history. And I think black people are collectively aware of that. So the tree can come to symbolize all kinds of things. I think the Billie Holiday song that Nina Simone and others have sung, Strange Fruit, which is about, you know, that song is really popular, but that song is about lynching. Mm-hmm. And I think there's still some power in the meaning of that. And sometimes you wonder, you know, at small microaggressions as a black person in certain spaces, including outdoor spaces. Outdoor spaces aren't immune from this. But I really want to emphasize that, for me, this isn't primarily about the fear. I think the fear is real. I think the history is real. And I think it's there. But I think we're bigger than that.
Carolyn, we are out of time, but thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me on. I appreciate it.
That's Professor Carolyn Finney of the University of California, Berkeley. We've been talking about her book, Black Faces, White Spaces, Reimagining the Relationship of African Americans to the Great Outdoors. Coming up after the news, the anniversary of a War of 1812 battle here in Wisconsin. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time.